guidance of only a single being, one of the dangerous prey, a host. The craving to strike, almost overpowering, suffusing the protector. The undeniable longing to collect the host, carry it back to the colony. Drives so strong they threaten to push out everything else. This is what the protector was made for. And yet, the protector feels the twang of a simultaneous and equally powerful need, one that fights against the impulse to collect. Two storms lashing against each other, each trying to devour the other. That second need, the compulsion to warn the colony. The protector waits. From the vibrations in the ground, the protector can tell the dangerous prey is also damaged. It makes bleating noises. The prey is crawling. The protector listens for loud stings. It hears none. It listens for the heavy, clomping steps of the dangerous prey. It hears none. And still it waits, simple yet efficient mind processing this war of urges. The protector is the sole survivor of its cadre. Instinct tells it to behave one way if in a group, another way if alone. When alone, the protector must be more cautious. If the protector is too aggressive, if it strikes and dies, the colony might not learn of the threat. The protector stays crouched in the shadows, hidden, motionless. The protector waits. The dangerous prey is two things, a host and a threat. A threat to other protectors, to the colony, to the queen. A threat so serious, none of its kind could be left alive. That was why the cadre pressed the attack. This was the second time the protector responded to a call against the species. The first time, the prey hosts had soft skins of different colors. The hosts were different sizes, too. Some were big, some were small. Some could loud sting. Most could not. When the fighting was done, though, all of the surviving hosts made those bleeding sounds of weakness, of fear. Those that survived were collected and taken to the colony. This time, though, the hosts, this dangerous prey, they looked the same, all of a similar size. All had mottled green skin, with hard areas not that different from the protector's own rigid carapace. The first time the protector faced this species, the prey scattered easily. They were then collected one or two at a time and taken back to the colony. The protector did not collect one. A primitive drive left unfulfilled. The second time, though, the dangerous prey operated like a cadre themselves. They remained coordinated throughout the battle. This alone made them a kill or be killed threat, even before the use of the loud stingers that proved so deadly. To defend the colony, the queen, the cadre struck. Early in the battle, the protector's arm took damage. Two loud stings rendered it unusable. By the time the protector recovered enough to rejoin the fight, the rest of the cadre was dead, as were most of the dangerous prey. All but one. A damaged one that can only crawl. The colony must know. A trail must be laid. Carrying the warning back home is all there is, the thing that must be done above all others. But there is also that basic primal need, the all-consuming biological demand to expand the colony. The protector waits. The protector listens. The protector feels. Finally convinced that the crawling, bleating host is alone, the protector rises from the shadows and silently closes in. The dangerous prey is too weak to fight. It bleats, louder than before. Will that sound bring more of its kind? Two tidal waves of need crash together. Survive and warn. Expand the colony. The protector will satisfy both urges. With its one good arm, it clumsily lifts the bleeding, dangerous prey. The host feels so dense. Smaller in size than the protector, but heavier in weight. The protector starts back toward the colony. As it walks, it drags its tail along the dirt and rocks, leaving a scent trail for others to follow. The protector is incapable of being happy, or sad, or angry. It returns to the colony, because that is what it is made to do. Soon, it hears the colony's low-frequency rumble buzz. The protector smells the us scent, the one that identifies the protector's colony as opposed to that of some enemy queen. The protector knows it is slowing down. The damage is significant and worsening. It knows it will not survive that much longer, but it will survive long enough to deliver the warning. And deliver the host. The protector carries the dangerous prey into the colony's main entrance. During most of the trip, the prey barely moved, but now it struggles. It fights, but it is too weak. The protector can't understand why a creature that weighs so much has so little strength. The colony is warm, comforting. It is thick with scents, acid, waste, chitin, with pheromones identifying individuals, castes, and groups. It is loud with noise, the low rumbles of sound produced by the folded air chambers within the protector's long heads, the high-pitched hisses of close communication, the endless tapping of claws and tails radiating through the secreted material that makes up most of the colony. Others notice the protector, notice what it is carrying. They flock to the host, touch it, smell it, sometimes taste it, listen to its strange bleeding. The protector senses growing agitation and anxiety in the others. They need to go out, to collect more hosts like these and bring them back. The protector presses its head against a wall, thick with the dried secretions of its kind. It hums out a message. The low-frequency vibration carries through the material, spreading through most of the colony. The message isn't a word, but it communicates a simple message that all understand. New hosts. This message brings more others. Many more. They swarm in from a dozen openings. The prey struggles against the hands reaching for it. It tries to turn its face away from those hands, but there are so many the face vanishes beneath a thick layer of twitching black. The bleeding, louder than ever before. Others press in so tightly that the protector can't move, is held upright by the massive bodies that want to know more about this host. Pheromones swirl. Noise thumps. A swaying mass of black undulates with an unstoppable rush of want. If there were words to be shouted, if there was a war cry to be screamed, the tunnels would shake with a single, maddening phrase, "Expand the colony." The protector's scent trail will lead the others back to the area of the battle, which is close to a host hive. But that scent trail signifies a path only. It doesn't communicate the level of threat. The protector emits low sounds from the long sound chamber that comprises most of its long head. 5 deep croaks to signify the 5 enemies the cadre encountered. The protector extends its secondary mouth, clacks it in a chattering pattern that signifies the dangerous prey can kill from a distance. The protector twitches its long head side to side, angles it sharply. The loud stings produce vibrations that confuse the senses. The next cadre needs to be prepared for this. Finally, the protector emits mimicked identifying scents of its 9 dead cadre mates, combined with the death scent, to communicate that they are gone. The dead protectors will not be remembered. They are only referenced so the others know that the dangerous prey can kill in high numbers. The dangerous prey are a threat to the colony. They must be collected, or they must be eliminated. The colony's activity intensifies. Agitation and aggressiveness toward this new threat combines with the overwhelming drive to collect more hosts. Others pack in close. They hiss and screech. They climb the walls. They skitter across the ceiling, driven by a desire that mimics madness. They throng together with an orgiastic need so pure and intense it borders on madness. This is what they were made for. The others start to pour out of the colony, following the protector's scent trail toward the prey's hive. The protector knows what it must do next. It takes the wounded prey deeper into the colony. The protector carries the host into the egg chamber. 2 others are there, guarding the eggs. No, the protector can't feel emotion, but there is an undeniable sensation at coming into this place. If that could be put into a single word, that word would be hope. In this room is the future of the colony, contained in the eggs that dot the floor. More scents. The protector moves to the part of the room that smells ready, where eggs have entered the final stage. The mature couriers inside the eggs seem to sense the presence of the host. The protector hears the rustling of little legs, the curling and contracting of tails, ready to launch the couriers toward any hosts that pass by the moment the eggs open. The couriers also make small sounds, instinctively tapping feet together in patterns that call out, "I am ready. Choose me." But one egg does more than tap, more than shiver and twitch. One egg sings. A signature sound, the likes of which the protector is only known through vibrations in the walls and floor. This sound calls to the protector, draws it in. Yes, this egg is the one. The protector is weakening. Too much damage. It has enough strength left, though, to hold the host against the wall near the singing egg. The prey has stopped bleating, stopped struggling. The protector and the two others press pieces of hard material against the prey's limbs, then spit on those pieces. The spit instantly grows tacky. Almost as quickly, the spit hardens, locking the host in place. The prey was dangerous. Now it is immobilized. Now it is cocooned. Soon, the egg will open. The courier will join with the host. The protector's legs give out. It stumbles, almost falls into another egg. Too much damage. The others in the egg chamber come closer. They touch. They smell. They taste. They secrete pheromones, not of concern, but rather of finality. The protector smells these pheromones, tastes them, and understands that the time has come for one last act, one final way to contribute to the colony. Weak, unable to move any further, the protector is placed in front of the queen. This protector has never before been in the queen's presence. Now that it is, the protector is a sensation of completeness, of fulfillment. The queen is glorious. The queen is everything. And the queen... the queen is dying. The protector understands. This final moment will help her survive a little while longer, and what helps the queen helps the colony. The queen lowers her huge, beautiful head, touches it to the protector's. The queen hums. The protector's body vibrates with that sound, with a song. In that song, the protector understands that the queen knows. Knows the protector brought a host. Knows the protector left a path to more hosts. In that sound, there is pride. Acceptance. There's something else that the protector's brain isn't sophisticated enough to comprehend, but if it could, that something else might be called gratitude. The protector has done well. And now, the protector can serve the colony in one final way. The protector has no concept of time, no concept of distance or space. There is no philosophy in its thoughts that it has lived a complete life, a life of selfless service. But there is a calmness, a sensation of peace. It did everything it was made to do. The pain will end. The queen's primary mouth opens. There is no struggle as sharp teeth slice through the protector's carapace, one scraping bite after another. As the protector's legs and arms and tail tremble and twitch, it feels and hears the queen feeding upon its body. The egg does not think. The egg does not feel. But the egg can sense. And the egg knows. There are three primary things an egg is engineered to recognize. Vibrations that indicate movement and size. Repetitive rhythms. The presence of a particular waste gas. Any two of these factors can combine to trigger muscle contractions, to peel back the lips that protect the courier deep inside. The egg's specialized cells detect the presence of that gas, CO2. Suitable hosts emit this gas. The egg doesn't understand this in any way. Wouldn't know what CO2 was if it even had a brain to understand anything, which it does not. It detects no vibrations that indicate movement of a nearby host. The egg doesn't listen, but it does feel. The egg's skin is a sensory organ so finely attuned it can detect not only the steps of a potential host, but also something far softer, the steady rhythm of a heart. Faint but unmistakable. Bum-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bump. A host is close by. Waste gases, a heartbeat. Almost. The heartbeat is erratic, weak. If it were stronger, steadier, the egg would have already opened. The egg's genetic code programs for one specific command above all others. Make sure the host is healthy enough to survive implantation and gestation. Because once the egg opens, the courier will soon die, whether the embryo is delivered or not. And the courier inside this egg, this courier above all others, it must deliver its embryo. The play of impulses across the egg's nervous system feeds into an automated yet complex response analysis process. CO2? Yes. But the host's pulse indicates it might not live long enough. Then, the erratic heartbeat steadies, becomes more rhythmic. The host isn't healthy, but it is healthy enough. With a soft squelch, the lips curl backward. For the first time ever, air caresses the courier's skin. Nerves fire. Neurotransmitters flood the delicate circulatory system. Muscles that have lain dormant finally twitch and flex. The courier doesn't think. It reacts. It responds. Evolution has ingrained a clock of sorts into the very fiber of its being. As soon as it is exposed to air, it must move quickly, for it will soon cease to function. The courier is engineered to find the target that must be nearby. It detects CO2, then a heartbeat. If neither of these things were present, it would still react to nearby movement. Any of these stimuli are enough to drive it to complete its purpose, its sole reason for existence. The courier stretches out 8 long, quivering limbs, limb tips press against the egg's firm wetness. The courier slides from the deep safety of this womb. Its tail remains in the moist warmth, while the rest of its body feels the coldness of this world. The courier focuses. CO2, the rhythm of a heartbeat, and it turns toward those stimuli. A courier's eyes are simple things. They detect movement and also areas of light and dark. It is the latter ability that best helps it in targeting. Across the universe, most advanced creatures have more than one eye, usually 2, but sometimes 3 or even 4. No matter how many eyes, though, all of these creatures have only one opening for the mouth. The mouth is where the courier needs to go. The courier scans the pattern of light and dark before it. 2 small darker areas, 1 large one. 8 limbs tremble. 8 limb tips press down. The tail coils, pushes against the egg's soft, firm interior. CO2, a heartbeat, 2 small spots above a larger one. The tail extends, hard and fast and instant, launching the courier through the air. Legs spread wide, ready to clutch, to hug. It lands. Limbs clamp around the host's head. The tail coils about the host's neck, squeezes tight. The host struggles. Teeth gnash together as if it knows what comes next. The courier's sensitive underbelly feels the host's lips, marks the location of teeth and jaws. The courier's tail constricts. The host's skin is warm, warmer than the air of the chamber. The courier feels the host's heartbeat increase, faster and faster and faster. The host struggles, resists, tries to endure, but it cannot draw air. When its own biology betrays it, when the mouth finally opens for a desperate breath, bony curves extend from the courier's underbelly, hook under the host's upper teeth and over the bottom teeth. The courier's powerful muscles hold the jaws open, prevent the teeth from biting down. The courier extends its proboscis into the host's open mouth, forces it down the host's warm, wet throat. The courier delivers lungfuls of air, keeping the host from suffocating. But the proboscis has another function, one just as important as delivering oxygen. Deep in the host's chest, in the lower esophagus, the future of the colony begins. This prey is dangerous. This prey is a threat to the colony. Such threats require absolute and overwhelming action. The protector does not mourn the one who laid this scent trail. The protector is as capable of sadness as it is of fear, which is to say, not at all. The protector is not intelligent, but is also not stupid. The protector can count, in a rudimentary way only. It can't multiply or divide. It has no words or symbols for the numbers it knows, and yet it knows the numbers. The protector recognizes the identifying scent of each and every other in this new cadre, this large cadre. 116 others. The largest cadre the protector has ever known. The scent trail ends. The protector clusters with the others in the darkness. Death scent permeates the air. A battle happened here. 9 protectors died. The hosts must be close by. The cadre must find them. The protector crouches on the soil, places its palms flat on the dirt and rocks. The others do the same. Through the ground, the protector feels the natural sensations of the nighttime landscape, a breeze blowing sand and dirt across the surface, the barely discernible tickle of nearby insects and small animals, the familiar cadence of another cadre moving across the ground somewhere nearby. And then, the protector feels it, so very faint and distant, the rhythmic thump of something solid, heavy, something on two legs, something not like itself, something alien. The protector turns its head to face slightly right, the direction from which the vibrations come. It does not know how far away this threat is, but it is not near. Silence is the constant rule, yet the protector is the de facto leader of this cadre. It risks a hiss. Just this protector, just one hiss, so enemies can't tell how many others there are. The sound wave spreads out, hits rocks and sparse plants, bounces back. The protector's echolocation maps objects in the area before it. In that area, it detects no movement. The protector stands taller. It hisses again, a little louder, so it can see a little farther. When these sound waves bounce back, the protector senses something else, something very important. Flat surfaces, thick forms rising high into the air. A hive. The protector silently stalks toward the hive. As one, the cadre rises and follows. The host's hive is massive. It is made up of many mounds with unnatural flat sides. The protector has never known anything so large. The protector's colony lies beneath the surface. This alien hive's tall mounds rise up to the sky. Many lights shine. It is night, it is dark, but in some places the hive is as bright as day. The cadre doesn't approach right away. It holds position behind a slight rise. The protector is the only one looking above that rise. The others stay down in the darkness, so still they look like rocks. Loud stings finally give away the prey's location. Rapid fire flashes, coming from the outside of one of the hive's mounds. This is the dangerous prey. The protector tries to count them, but they are behind small barricades, and the flashes make it difficult to identify individuals. The protector's primitive brain first thinks 7, then 8. Another cadre is attacking the dangerous prey. The hosts do not flee. They stand their ground. So many flashes, so many loud stings. The protector watches as his kind fall, one after another. Some lie still, some twitch, some thrash in place. A few rise and continue the attack, only to be struck down again. Even from this distance, the loud stingers create painful shock waves. The protector's body, the bodies of the others, evolved to sense vibration and sound. They all suffer from the concussive forces echoing sharply from behind the barricades. The protector quietly calls out. Two others approach. These individuals aren't special. There is no leader caste. Protectors are almost identical to one another. These two responded to the call, simply because they were closest. The three protectors press in against each other. When their bodies are touching, the low-frequency signals made in their long vocal chambers are transmitted by conduction. To call what happens next a plan is too grandiose a term. A plan would require forethought, analysis, strategy. What happens is far simpler than that. The other on the protector's right drops back behind the ridge and scurries away to the right. 30 others following silently along with it. The other on the protector's left also drops behind the ridge. It and 30 more just like it will rush toward the dangerous prey from this very spot. Where there was one cadre, now there are three. The protector drops down. Its cadre is small enough now for completely silent communication. No hisses to be heard, no taps to be detected. Its body shivers, stomps, shivers, stomps, a pattern that causes the others to cluster tightly around it. It joins hands with two others, who join hands with others next to them, and so on until all are packed in close and connected by touch. The protector squeezes simple rhythms, sending messages. This is not a language so much as it is the communication of basic concepts. This one goes first. Other ones follow. Quiet, slow, at hive, cadre hides, waits, silence. When this one strikes, others strike. The protector drops to all fours and scurries off to the left. 56 others follow. The protector crouches in the shadows near a hive opening. It is watched. It is seen. The desire to strike is almost overwhelming. The need to defend the hive, the urge to collect hosts, these instinctive drives pulse through the protector as strong and fast as its own heartbeat, glow like the strange lights that dot the tall hive mounds. But the protector waits, as does the cadre behind it. The protector saw one of the dangerous prey come out of that opening, run to join the fight against the other cadres. The protector saw that the opening closed by itself, a moving wall sealing it up. If it opened once, perhaps it will open again. Around the opening, piles of objects form barricades. The protector understands these barricades are similar to ones it helped make back in the colony. Barricades that block, that protect, that channel an enemy into a predictable path. Behind the barricade stands one of the dangerous prey. It holds a loud stinger, the biggest one the protector has seen yet. This loud stinger seems to be a part of the dangerous prey, connected to it by an extra arm made of metal. So close. A viable host, right there, only a short sprint away. To subdue it, to take it back to the colony, the compulsion to collect is so powerful. The protector faces a difficult, reactive choice. Collect the lone dangerous prey now, or continue to wait. This dangerous prey isn't part of the larger fight. It is guarding the hive opening, which means there could be more hosts inside. Expand the colony. The protector's every decision is a thing of pure logic, a mathematical equation, free of creativity. The protector's brain evaluates variables, compares them in a pre-weighted system that was in place long before it was born. Capture one host or multiple? Multiple. The protector doesn't decide to wait, per se. It simply does not move at that moment. A rumbling sound, high frequency and low frequency both. The protector feels something coming, something heavier than a cadre sprinting at full speed. Then, the protector sees what is shaking the ground. A hive that moves. The moving hive roars, lets out a cone of flame. The protector's body shudders with pain from the shockwave. A loud sting, but so powerful it stuns the protector into stillness for a few moments. Another roar as something explodes out among the cadre attacking the hive. So much new information. So many new sensations. The protector waits. It hisses, trying to see all there is to see on the battlefield. Echoes come back. Echoes of moving prey. Four. No. Five. Running quickly away from the attacking cadres. Multiple hosts. Running. Fleeing. They are coming closer. They're headed for the hive entrance. The wall that sealed the entrance? It slides back. The hive is open. The protector rises. The others rise with it. Low and on all fours, the protector gallops toward the hive opening. The others close behind. They instinctively move to three abreast. The protector, front and center. The cadre understands loud stings, how deadly they are. If fired upon, the three in front will act as a shield, taking damage so that the others behind them may get closer. The long, fast-moving column of apex predators closes in. The dangerous prey reacts quickly, lets out a sound of alert, turning to point the large, loud stinger toward the cadre. Flashes erupt from the end. The other on the protector's left is knocked backward. The other on the protector's right loses an arm in a blast of chitin, acid, and flesh. The protector launches itself high into the air, just as more flashes from the loud sting tear into the others behind it. The dangerous prey angles the loud stinger up, but it is too late. The protector arcs over the barricade and kicks down hard, its full weight smashing the dangerous prey to the ground. Others scramble over the barricade. They're met with a deafening cacophony of loud stings. The protector smells pheromones of agony, of death. It suffers the concussive pains of the dangerous prey's loud stings. The protector is so close to serving the colony in the best way it possibly can. The sensation triggers a rush of hormones that increase aggression. In just a few seconds of action, the protector is awash in a swirling ocean of input and sensation. The dangerous prey with the extra arm makes bleating noises. It starts to rise. It is so dense, so heavy, yet for all that weight, it is weak. The protector clutches tight with hands, feet, and tail. It must neutralize the dangerous prey. The protector opens wide its primary mouth. The 2 kilogram secondary mouth fires outward at over 20 meters per second, smashing into the prey's thorax, denting the mottled green carapace. The prey shudders, but doesn't stop. It struggles to rise. The protector has more strength than the prey, but not enough mass to hold the prey down. Another protector grabs the prey, then another, holding it in place. The prey fights. The protector aims for the head, then again strikes with the secondary mouth. The 2 kilogram weapon smashes into the prey's face at the same time the tiny jaws sink through flesh and lock onto cheekbone. Blood flies. The prey struggles. The protector feels internal muscles contract, forcing fluid through 2 hollow teeth of the secondary mouth. Almost immediately, the prey slows, weakens. The dangerous prey stops struggling. Through the secondary mouth, the protector can feel the prey's heartbeat. Slow, steady, strong. This host is still alive. It is healthy. Others are swarming through the open entrance. A few dangerous prey struggle on, but they are overwhelmed, buried under a wave of shiny black chitin and twitching tails. The protector gathers up its host and quickly moves away from the hive. The others will search inside, collecting potential hosts, killing anything that is too dangerous to capture. From inside that hive, the protector hears loud stings, few and far between at first, then none at all. The battle is over. For now, at least, the colony is safe. The protector finds the scent trail. The host it carries must be taken back to the colony, to the egg chamber. The young queen awakens. An instinctive process begins. She must escape. She must break free. Legs, small but powerful, kick out hard. She feels her crown press against the host's sternum. Her entire body contracts, then expands all at once, trunk and tail and legs combining to deliver all of her strength to a few square centimeters. She feels the restraining bone crack. She coils again, explodes again, feels the crack widen. The third time, she feels the host's bone splinter and its flesh tear. Her body makes it halfway out. The host's body twitches around her, shivering in its final death throes. The new queen opens her mouth for the first time. She cannot yet see. She hisses. The sound waves that bounce back tell her she is not alone. Hands lift her, pull her free. Gentle hands, loving hands. She is carried. She feels protected. The caring hands hold something to her mouth. She smells it, is instantly overwhelmed by the need to eat. She would eat anything she is given. But this particular food is meant only for her, only for queens to be. At this stage of life, her body is impossibly dense. A small percentage of it consists of normal cells, muscle, brain, nervous system, a few temporary organs that will be gone in a few hours. Most of her, however, consists of millions upon millions of compressed cells that contain almost no fluid. These waiting cells are packed so tight, they are a nearly solid mass. A digested food spreads through her system. These compacted cells absorb moisture and nutrients. The cells begin to expand. The little queen is like a long, dry sponge, finally exposed to water. Fluid swells within these dormant cells. Her density drops, but her size increases exponentially. Were she alone, without the support of her colony, the little queen would eat whatever she could find. Her sharp, dense teeth can cut through almost anything. And almost anything she can swallow down, her digestive system can process. With this specialized food, however, This sustenance specifically meant for the body of a young queen, her growth rate is launched into overdrive. Her cells expand. They divide. Within a half hour, her skin grows too tight, so constrictive that crinkling lines form with flesh bulging between them. An hour after her birth, that skin splits. Her body swells. She becomes longer, thicker. The newly exposed skin quickly begins to harden, to provide support to her body and new limbs. This skin will last only a few hours before she is again too large, and the process repeats. Her protectors can reach full size in little more than a day. She is much, much larger, yet it will take her less than a week to reach adult size. Shortly after that happens, her body will begin to produce eggs. The loving hands finally set the young queen down. She can almost stand on her own. Protectors help her stay upright. She smells, tastes their individual pheromone signatures. Her tail presses against the ground, but it is still too weak to hold her weight. The young queen hears something. A low sound. A song. One that is made only for her. One that defines her. That song is picked up by the protectors. They echo it, amplify it, so that it spreads throughout the colony. In that song is the young queen's identity. I am. I exist. She has a sense of self. She's an individual. Those around her are not. They are extensions of her. All but one. The young queen is finally able to see. She can hear, feel, she can detect vibrations. All of these senses are assaulted at once. The smells, the tastes, the sounds, the sight. Before her is her mother, 100 times larger. Sprawling crown, shiny black carapace, thin arms, delicate trunk, long teeth. The large queen leans her head over the smaller one. Thick mucus drips down from the older into the mouth of the younger, who swallows it down, adding more specialized nutrition and precious fluid to her rapidly expanding body. Old queen is beautiful and precious, but there is also a scent coming off of her that is disturbing. Because old queen is dying. Hisses, taps, low thrums, pheromones. The two queens share something that the protectors could never know. A conversation. An actual exchange of information and ideas. The two queens don't have long. Old queen knows she must pass on her knowledge before time runs out. Young queen listens, so very carefully. Together, in the half-light, mother and daughter discuss the future of the colony. The author would like to thank Chris Grawl, Master Sergeant, U.S. Army Special Forces, retired, for his assistance with making cadre instincts in silent communication logical and consistent with proven tactics from elite military ground forces. The author would also like to thank Gwen Pearson, Ph.D. in entomology, for her feedback in use social insect communication and colony behavior. The work of University of Missouri biologist Rex Cockcroft was also instrumental in applying actual insect communication methods to the xenomorphs.
Spite by Tim Leben. Let's get busy. Sprunkle's familiar pre-mission call echoed around the dropship's interior, but no one responded as they plunged into the huge habitat's weak atmosphere. A heavy vibration settled into the vessel, and Durand closed her eyes as her combat suit absorbed much of the impact. She always hated this part. Dropping into an atmosphere, however weak it may be, after weeks traveling through deep space, was always a shock to the system. Gravity taking hold, ship shaken and buffeted by atmospherics, and knowing that the end of their journey was near, as were the dangers that might face them there. In this instance, there was little indication of what awaited them. The colony on Weller's world had fallen silent, and they were the nearest colonial marine unit on hand to go and investigate. The fact that they were on their way home from a 2-year tour of Delta Quadrant hadn't come into the equation. Major Coco Haley had accepted their orders without question, selected the crew to take down with her on the dropship, and 2 hours ago, they'd left the comfort of the destroyer Ariel on this final mission.
"My nuts are shaking loose," Narcissi said.
"You've got no nuts," Bestwick replied. "I sliced them off when you were in hypersleep. You just haven't thawed enough to notice."
Laughter swelled around the dropship's interior. Then Major Haley's voice cut in.
"System and weapon checks in 5 minutes. I want you all green across the board before we hit the surface."
Durand sighed. She'd willingly follow Haley into the jaws of hell, but the Major did little to shed her Snow Dog nickname. She was as cool and distant as they came. Around the dropship's circular hold, the Colonial Marines went through their self-checking procedures. Durand interrogated her combat suit and came up all systems online and fully functional. Next, she assessed her comm rifle, zeroing every reading so that levels were refreshed. Laser, plasma, and nano charges were all full. Finally, she and her neighbor, the big guy, Misra, confirmed each other's readings. Everyone announced themselves fully prepped. Major Haley nodded. Their vital signs would be displayed on her own combat suit's visor, and she turned her head slowly as she assessed her crew. Bestwick and Narcissi sat to her left, Sprenkle and Edels to her right, and Durand and Misra were across the hold from her. They were a good, solid team who'd fought battles together, faced danger and death, and dished out their fair share. Durand knew that the Major was more used to leading large complements of the 39th Spaceborne, known as the Devil Dogs, into patrol and combat situations. But Snowdog also enjoyed these smaller, more personal missions. Some said she was a former frail addict, replacing the drug's allure with the thrill of combat. Durand had no opinion on the matter, and even if she had, she'd never share it.
4 minutes, Pike said from the cockpit. I've picked up the beacon, no signs of anything amiss.
Circle the facility, Haley said. Durand, with me. They unclipped their harnesses and passed through into the cockpit, grabbing hold of storage strapping as the ship was buffeted by Weller's weak atmosphere. The artificial habitat was huge and looked like any one of a score of planets Durand had landed on over the 11 years of her time as a Colonial Marine. Blasted, bare, lifeless. This place was scarred and inimical due to the light atmosphere belched from the massive processors several miles to the east. Storms raged.
No place to spend Christmas, Durand said.
No place to be at all, Pike said. These assholes deserve every credit of their pay.
Yeah, well, you don't always have a say in where the company sends you, the Major said.
This is a Weyland-Yutani base, Durand asked, surprised. They hadn't been appraised of that. All indications were that this was an independent facility. She thought maybe they were contractors earning a crust overseeing the atmosphere processors, or perhaps some sort of scientific base funded by one of the institutes.
Not exclusively, Haley said.
But the company has interests everywhere, you know that. And I have orders. There's research being done here and we're to retrieve it, if at all possible.
What about the base's crew?
Help them, if we can. They're still the priority.
She glanced away, and Durand thought, the priority for us, but probably not the company.
What's happened here, Major? Durand asked. No one seems to know, but all comm systems seem intact, and from what I can see, there's no structural damage.
Not externally, at least, Pike said.
Durand was troubled. They'd been led to believe that this was a search and rescue, and now, minutes before setting down, Haley was revealing more. Major? She asked. Haley smiled. It was a rare occurrence.
Durand, don't sweat it. My people always come first, you know that. Whatever the company wants, if we can do it, we will.
Yes, boss.
You're my wingman on this, Haley said.
Got it?
Durand nodded. They'd known each other a long time. She'd never had cause to mistrust her major, and she wasn't about to start now.
Pike, put us down, Haley said.
Fully suited, due to the toxic atmosphere, all comm systems open, the six Marines followed their major into the facility's eastern quarter. It was a large base, consisting of a main central hub, with four arms projecting from it, landing pad to the north, and external buildings scattered at various distances. It had the look of an older settlement, expanded, extended, with several trash sites and a surrounding landscape flattened and scarred from vehicle wheels. Records indicated the habitat was over 200 years old, and Durand suspected that the base had been here almost from the beginning. Misra was her double. In situations like this, they always worked in pairs, covering each other's backs, placing their full trust in one another. They'd fought together many times before, and acting together felt as natural as breathing. Inside the main doors, everything appeared normal. Bestwick closed the doors behind them, and the air movement settled. Silence fell.
Forward. Slow. Haley whispered.
They all heard through their combat suits. The corridor was wide and low and scattered with litter, walls scraped and battered, all signs of it being a well-used thoroughfare. No traces of combat. No movement.
Narcissi? Haley said.
Narcissi held his motion detector ahead of him and moved slightly ahead of the group. His instrument's readings played across their visors, showing a rough schematic of the structure up to 30 meters ahead. Nothing moved.
Boss, I can patch into facility communications here,
Edel said. She busied herself at a comm point on the wall, while the rest of the Marines spread out in a protective pattern. Durand tried to make sense of the place. The Major had given no indication as to what research they were looking for, and perhaps she hadn't even been told. It was hard to discern, from present surroundings, just what this base's prime purpose might be. It was likely that over the years its use had changed. And now... now, something had gone wrong.
Nothing, Edel said.
I've scanned all channels. There's no chatter, and the comms haven't been accessed for over 19 days.
Whatever happened here was a while ago,
Sprinkle said.
Stay alert, Haley said, unnecessarily.
The whole squad were on tiptoes. They knew very well that some of the worst dangers could stay dormant for some time. They moved on, heading along the Eastern Arm's central corridor and approaching the first doors leading off into side rooms.
Misra and Durand on the left.
Bestwick and Sprinkle, right, Haley said. Take it in turns.
They worked methodically, scanning the rooms behind closed doors with a variety of instruments before entering. Motion detectors, heat monitors, gas spectrum analyzers. They found offices, sleeping quarters, and storage rooms, but nothing alive. No sign of whatever had gone wrong. After 50 minutes, they reached the base's circular hub. This was a much larger structure, several stories high, and it would take a lot longer to search.
Two squads?
Misra asked, but the Major shook her head.
I don't like this. It'll take longer, but I want us to stay together. We do this floor first, then work our way upwards. I want to see if...
Major, movement,
Narcissi said.
Durand moved to the left and crouched, Misra right beside her.
They aimed their comm rifles along the gently curving corridor, and Durand checked out the motion readings.
"Next floor up," she said. "Seems confused, like..."
"Like a swarm,"
Misra said.
"Nice choice of word," Durand said. "Thanks for that."
"Let's move,"
Haley snapped, and they followed her towards a nearby open staircase. Senses heightened by the first signs of something active, they moved smoothly and quickly up the stairs, cautious on the half-landings, suits scanning ahead and relaying information to their visors and ear implants. Every Marine was trained to keep one eye on reality at all times. Suits could malfunction. Data and displays could be misread. It was Durand who saw the first movement before any suit system spotted it.
"Head of the stairs," she said, aiming at the shifting shape.
She didn't fire. It could have been one of the facility's staff, confused or injured, or afraid of what was happening. But her fingers stroked the trigger, and she stared at the place where she'd seen the object.
"What was that?"
Misra asked.
"Dunno."
The two of them had taken point. By the time Haley crouched behind them, everything was motionless once more.
"Maybe a shadow,"
Haley said, and Durand grunted, because she knew better than to mistake a shadow for something it wasn't, and they all knew that.
"What's that stink?"
Edels asked. Durand took in a slow, deep breath.
"Burning," she said. "That's burning flesh."
"No," Bestwick said. "Burnt flesh. There's no heat left to it."
At the top of the staircase, the corridor headed in one direction, and at its end, past heavy doors warped and broken from their hinges, they found the first of the large control rooms.
"Holy shit,"
Durand whispered. She tried to settle and calm her breathing, but she allowed in the shock just for a moment. Denying it was not possible. Everything was burnt. Everyone was burnt. The whole area was scorched black, swaths of soot coating walls, floor, and ceilings, computer terminals ruined, furniture slumped down into strange sculptures. The dead were twisted into crisp statues, a few on their own, many more stacked against two emergency exit doors that had failed to open. These piles were grotesque, sprouting thin limbs and melted heads, with flesh burnt away to expose blackened bones, cracked and crumbled beneath the terrible heat. Metal structures had melted, and a platform halfway around the room had collapsed.
"Move in, but slowly," Haley said. "Sprankle, Bestwick, count the dead."
"Seriously?" Bestwick asked.
"Best guess," Haley said.
"There were 98 personnel stationed here. We'll start keeping count. Edels, locate the nearest staircase."
A couple of minutes later, they moved on. Bestwick estimated 40 dead in that one large room. And when they climbed to the next level, they found many more. These were piled in three rooms, barricaded doors melted from their mounts, bodies contorted into terrible, agonized poses. Many corpses had become one. Durand was only glad there were few facial features to recognize, although she saw several smaller, wretched shapes, which could only have been children.
"What the hell could do this?" she asked.
"Plasma weapons?"
Misra asked, but they all heard the doubt in his voice.
"No weaponry we know," Haley said. "Structures are largely sound, superficial damage. Not even flamethrowers would be this precise. Whatever did this was just after the people."
"I think we can say this is a done deal," Bestwick said.
"I concur," Sprankle said. "No sign of movement or activity. No survivors." "We should sweep the rest of the base,"
Misra said.
"We will," Haley said. She glanced at Durand,
then looked away. What the fuck is this? Durand wondered. Were the company experimenting with something that malfunctioned? Some new weapon?
We'll finish this wing, Haley said. North wing next, then more movement, Sprenkle said. All around and incoming.
That swarm again, Durand said, and she glanced at Misra.
Got your back, he said.
Positions, Haley said, and there was no need for her to elaborate. They knew how to set up a defensive structure. Three of them faced one way along the corridor, four the other. And they could only wait as the motion detector showed the swarm closing in. They all saw them at the same time.
What the fuck?
Bestwick said, her voice swallowed in the explosion of gunfire. Durand opened up with short, controlled laser bursts. Her suit darkened its visor to the glare of exploding and flashing ordnance, but she still saw the flitting, streaking things flying along the corridor towards them and erupting in flames as they were taken down. They were slightly larger than her fist, airborne and moving quickly towards them. Her suit marked targets, and she continued firing, switching rapidly from laser to nanomunitions when targets became too numerous. The creatures dodged and twitched, some of them escaping the Marines' onslaught. Many more? Not. They blew apart, crashed against the walls and ceiling, splashing across the floor as wet smears. And each one seemed to explode, as if filled with compressed gas. The atmosphere here was not oxygen-rich, so Durand assumed that these beasts had some sort of internal combustion source. That made sense. Those people had been burned to death. As Durand switched her aim from creature to creature, terrible confirmation came from the other direction.
Narcissi, watch out!
Boss, duck, don't let them...
Edels, out of the fucking way!
Oh no! Edels!
The scream was loud and sustained, and Durand risked a quick glance behind her. Edels had taken one single deadly step towards the attacking throng, and now the things surrounded her, seeming to hover or drift close to her while she burned. Fire erupted from their mouths. It streamed out like liquid flame, twisting in the air, pouring and floating in defiance of gravity, impacting against Edels and melting through her protective suit as if it was hardly there. Narcissi tried to go to her aid, but Haley held him back. Edels screamed. Her voice was high and agonized. She thrashed, dropped her weapon, and then started running away from her companions.
Edels,
Durand breathed, knowing that she was watching her friend die. The beasts swarmed, still exhaling that strange, lava-like fire onto their vulnerable victim. As she ran through their midst, more and more were attracted to her conflagration. Black, oily smoke belched from her ruptured suit, and the stink of cooking meat filled the air.
Grenade,
Edels croaked, her voice wet and hot. Durand and the others realized her intention, all of them crouching mere seconds before the explosion. It ripped along the corridor, destroying a score of the fire beasts and sweeping a blast wall ahead of it, knocking more of them from the air to bounce and skitter across the floor. Durand jumped up, braced her legs, brought her comm rifle up into a firing position and unleashed a stream of nanomunitions against the creatures still rolling and struggling on the floor. The resultant haze of small explosions killed them all. She shifted her gaze, eyes wide, breath light and fast. Edels was spread all over the corridor. Durand had seen plenty of people die, a few of them friends. But she'd never seen someone she cared about go out like this. There was not even comfort in hoping it had been quick, because it hadn't. After the screaming and the burning, the detonation had merely been the end point of a tortured demise.
Motherfucker!
Durand shouted,
and she fired several short laser blasts past the blood and flesh-spattered area where Edels had died. The shots illuminated the corridor briefly, casting shadows of several creatures flitting rapidly away from the chaos.